about 6 o'clock, so everybody's time. Let's get our meeting started. Let's call it order. And everybody get a chance to read the meeting notes from April 23rd. Is there a motion to approve our?
A motion to approve meetings.
Second.
I'm sorry, who seconded? Thank you.
Multiple seconds.
All right, we do have one public attendee. We've got Shasta Hill, and she's a nursing student. Nice to have you tonight. And we're going to actually switch our agenda around a little bit. We're going to do our business first, and then the big part of our meeting will be a film that Roxanne found.
You'll
introduce it. So we'll do that first. So we'll do our department updates. And Alan.
So, budget.
Oh, okay, thank you. So it's all right. I'm not going to give any detail here. That you might remember 2 years ago in the previous session, we got $11 million for foundational public health services statewide. Some of the money, I think a couple million, went to DOH. The rest of it, $9 million, went to local public health departments across the state, and there was about $1 million set aside for some 3 innovative projects, shared services projects, one in Tacoma, Pierce, one in Spokane, and one in King County. So this past session, the legislature passed and the governor signed into law funding, not only funding for foundational public health services, but they're now defined in state statute. And the funding, which is $22 million, we'd asked the public health system across the state had asked for, original ask was for $296 million. Then we dropped it to 100. We got 22. The good news is it's more than last time. It's ongoing funding, so we don't have to ask for it theoretically every session. The bad news is that it's only $22 million, but at least it's a start. We've been having the ultimate decision about how much money will be available for local health jurisdictions in the state is going to be made mainly by the Steering Committee for Foundational Public Health Services. That includes some members from WSAPA, our state organization, or local public health officials. But the bottom line is, it's $22 million. There's going to be at least $2 million for the state health department out of that. There will be $1.2 million for tribes. We all agreed, we had a meeting of our own group of local public health officials, that $3 million should go to King County because they had gotten that additional money last session in addition to the 12, and their legislative delegation was really supportive of foundational public health services, and they have huge needs. So there's $3 million going there. There's discussion about whether the innovative the pilots that were done last time should continue or whether we should add more. The bottom line is we're going to get somewhat more than we got last time, but I can't tell you how much more than what we got last time. And last time I think it amounted to about 250 something thousand per year, if I remember correctly. So hopefully we'll have at least as much as we had last time. It'll be ongoing. I don't know if anybody has any questions about it.
Will it be the same amount ongoing, or will that change?
Hopefully it'll be more, but I can't say how much more it'll be.
Then you can solicit more, even though it's an ongoing
amount. In future sessions, can we ask for more? Yes. Yes, we can. And hopefully we will, because most of us consider $22 million just a small down payment. So that original ask of $296 was actually lowered from about 450. You may recall a year ago we were involved in this. We had a consultant, and we all the local health jurisdictions in the state and the state health department filled out this survey, which is this extensive survey that basically looked at the services we're providing and the staffing and the costs involved with them around foundational public health services and capabilities. And that included our communicable disease programs, our environmental public health programs, our assessment unit, our epidemiology function that was considered a foundational capability. We all costed that out. We all said where the gaps were, and that's how we came up with that original ask. original, to fill the gaps and actually do foundational, do what's really essential around foundational public health services. We figured we needed $450 million of biennium. Our ask was 296. We ended up with 22. So we will be asking for more funding in future sessions. I think we have an obligation, which we will do, to demonstrate what we've done with the additional dollars, just like we're all doing with the original $11 million. The other point I'd make is, you know, one of those foundational capabilities or foundational services had to do with getting immunization rates up. There are a lot of challenges around immunization rates, especially around, it came up in the recent measles outbreak, even our data systems around vaccination rates and how there's two different data systems. One is the school report, and I'm not gonna get into the detail, but the other one is the state registry, and they don't communicate really well. There's a lot more work we can be doing about getting accurate data around kids who are immunized or unimmunized in school. So we predicted that, you know, that was something we needed to work on, and, you know, not having that in place increases the chance of an outbreak, and, you know, look what we just had, so, and what we're continuing to have. So those are some things we're going to advocate for. I'm probably talking too much again, so.
So do you want to talk about the measles?
Thank you. Throughout the measles outbreak, we were measuring costs. So we were actually accounting for costs, which included everything from staff time that was working on this, including overtime, included the cost of having people from other jurisdictions in the state come in, you know, whatever we had to put into. We had, like, for example, we had some folks from Idaho health departments here who were helping us out, and we, you know, had to pay for travel and lodging and food and all that other good stuff. So we costed out the what it cost us to do the measles response, and it ended up being $864,000. Of that, about $80,000 was covered in grants, because, like, for example, our preparedness folks are paid through grants, but the rest we had to come up with county general fund dollars. We made an ask to the legislature, and the legislature gave us, appropriated $744,000 to pay for our outbreak response. So that was really good news. That goes back into our fund balance. Okay, that was quick.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?
So you're also doing the legislative update?
Okay.
And then, I know.
You're not going to hear me much longer. I'll be really quick on this. Couple of good news around, besides foundational public health services, we, unlike Oregon, got a bill passed that basically removes the personal/philosophic exemption to measles, mumps, rubella vaccine for school. It includes daycares and preschools and as well. It took a lot of work. We should really thank, Representative Harris was a driving force behind that bill. I think Monica Stonier helped out as well. Senator Cleveland behind the scenes in terms of helping out in terms of getting rid of some of the amendments to get the bill out of the House. Some really horrible amendments were tacked onto it that were basically anti-vaccine language. That we end up having to get removed, and it took a lot of wangling and a lot of phone calls and a lot of discussions and a lot of work on the part of people, including Senator Cleveland, and we ended up getting a clean bill that was passed and signed by the governor, which doesn't have the anti-vaccination language in it. If you want more details, I'd be happy to give that to you, but unless you have any questions, I'll move on. I talk about the tobacco vape. Representative Harris is also championing around the bill that actually raised the age for both tobacco products as well as vaping products to 21. So that passed and is signed. So that's really good news as well. Especially if you look at the Healthy Youth Survey that shows vaping going up among adolescents, I think it's really good news to get that passed.
You know, I saw something just in the newspaper today about maybe it was over the weekend, I don't know, but
about their finding that the vaping with the liquids is creating, did anybody see this about heart disease?
Yeah, I saw some.
So interesting to find out more about how they, you know, what's precipitating that news, but it's not as safe as everybody thinks.
Yeah, it's being touted as a harm reduction, and there might be some, who knows, in terms of people who are already smokers. The problem with it is that besides the effects that are not really known about, it's a very efficient drug delivery system. And the concern is, especially with kids, that they get, that's one way to get addicted to nicotine, and then they could go on to combustible cigarettes as well, which happens a lot. So getting it to the 21, but yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, when you think about it, you're inhaling it and it's going into your alveoli, you know, the membranes in the lung, and whatever's in there you're exposing.
Yeah, what's in those, you know, you just think about what's in those vaping liquids that smell like blueberries, and they're not blueberries, but it's some chemical that's...
Yeah, there's a lot that's
really
kind
small.
Of...
I saw somebody doing it, I didn't even know.
They look like, see, the other problem with kids is they look like pens.
Or they're really
they
like,
could be
they look like thumb drives.
Yeah, exactly. Thumb drives, yep, you're right. If they look like thumb drives.
Yeah, they're small. I didn't know that. I was wondering that.
Well, they come in different sizes.
Yeah, right. But they're smaller than I thought. When they first, the vape pens used to just kind of look like a long liquid cigarette, but they're like little.
Yeah. My understanding also, and Alan, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the vaping fluid is also not necessarily regulated. Right? There's no real standard.
Yeah, well, it's not. There's no FDA. Yeah.
Right. What's in it? What's not in it? I mean, so it could be anything. To your point, you know.
I wonder if the size has gotten smaller and therefore the concentration has gotten stronger.
I don't think we've seen the end to the impact of vaping on people's lives.
No, they haven't been around very long, and you know, doing the studies. I think about how long it took to figure out what tobacco was up, you know, until we realized that. So people haven't been vaping that long, so it's going to take a number of years. But I think I think I'd be really cautious about it.
There are probably, I mean, like you said, it's like there's all sorts of different chemicals that they use for different vape pens, right? Because there's different flavors and...
Oh, you can put THC in it.
Well,
so,
yeah.
So you can put it whatever you want in it. You could put any kind of drug you want in it, really.
So we'll probably find that certain kinds, just like different dyes have concern than other dyes and food. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm also concerned. It is a really good delivery device for nicotine, which is one of the most addictive substances known to mankind. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
Okay. So, one other thing in your package you have, we talked about this at the last meeting. There's a Washington Firearm Tragedy Prevention Network that's happening in Wenatchee. That's next month. But I also wanted to include they were able to send me the agenda, so that's actually in your packet as well. If you know of anybody, if you'd like to attend, or if you know anyone that would like to attend, you can certainly forward this. We'll have the link in the notes too. You can forward it to your any colleagues that you might that might be interested. It looks like a really good conference, and a lot around. You know, school-based nurses, that would be great for nurses to attend, for counselors, people like that. So if you know anyone that would be interested, or yourself, you're certainly welcome to attend. All right.
Okay. So
we're
in the membership update.
Okay, you want to do that? Sure. So we had a couple of resignations. Steve Becker, which I think you all were aware of, he was our consumer, resigned a couple of a few weeks back, and then Dr. Neville, Lawrence Neville, has also just resigned. So we're in the process of doing some recruitment for the consumer position, and then we'll be engaging and working with Peace Health to replace Dr. Neville. So hopefully we'll have some new members shortly. We're going to be, as far as the recruitment piece of it, it's going to go into the Columbia, and I think that's where we advertise it into some other places as well. So if you have anyone that you know is interested or is considering, let me know. Let Lydia and I know. We'll certainly reach out to those folks. Okay. And then the other thing is we have some terms that are coming up in September. And what we'll be doing is we'll be doing some outreach, individual emails to the folks that have their terms coming up to see if you'd be interested in continuing on for an additional term. So you'll probably be seeing those emails coming out in the next month or so. Terms are up, the people who are rotating your terms are up in September. So be alert.
Does it seem like more people than we normally have? Or is it pretty normal?
I think it's pretty normal. What we were trying to do is we were trying to stagger them too, because I think there for a while we had everybody coming up at the same time, which was a little bit challenging. So we were trying to get a little bit more on a staggered schedule. So we will have, you know, September is the usual.
About 3 to 5 people.
So that's about that. So all right, so that's that. So is that
right? Yeah. So
So one of the things, so we're going to be showing a film tonight, which I know you all are excited about. Dr. Melnick wanted us to bring in popcorn, but I failed miserably on the popcorn front. I apologize to everyone. to give you an idea, we've spent a lot of time narrowing down our topic areas. You know, we went through exercises last year, and the topic areas that we're working and we're focusing on are gun safety and suicide prevention. But one of the things that came out of those discussions was that ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, really underlie a lot of everything we're looking at from the perspective of FAC. So we've had a few members on FAC and Board of Health. We recently, just last week, we did some education for Board of Health with regard to ACEs. They're very interested in resiliency. They're very interested in looking at trauma-informed policy. So we're very, very excited. But what we thought we would do is we have another film that has come out that is really excellent, and we wanted to share that with you all. And before we have some partner presentations about gun safety and suicide prevention in June, and so I'll talk a little bit more about those upcoming meetings and who's going to be attending. But we really wanted to have this to sort of, again, do a little bit of, revisit ACEs, what it is, talk about some of the new new science or the new data that we've got around adverse childhood experiences. This film is called Broken Places. And it describes ACEs as well as how to overcome and mitigate ACEs in our community. So that's very, very exciting. As you watch the film, if you could please just think about trauma-informed policy as it relates to gun violence and suicide prevention, but also what we can do as individuals. There's a lot of information in this film about what we can do as individuals in our organizations, and also in your role as FAC in advising the Board of Health. So we'll have a discussion afterwards, so keep that in mind as you're looking at the film. And I'll have a few questions, but what we're gonna do is after the film is over, we'll be having some discussion about it and sort of next steps and what what potentially you can do with this information. All right, so I think we're ready to go.
Okay.
All right, I'm gonna turn off the light. So no sleeping, okay?
I need cookies left.
There's cookies left, don't worry. Yeah.
Go for it, guys. Turn it up.
You think a little bit higher?
I'm waiting to see what the dialogue does.
Tell me if it's too loud.
The other one.
That one does both of them.
Here it comes.
Okay. I think that's good. Thank you.
From a young age,
age, being in foster care. I knew I had a chance of not making it. Being my mom not being in my life, I knew I had a bigger chance of not making it. My brother and myself not having fathers, bigger chances of not making it. Nobody cared about me or him. So because of that, we have to protect each other. We always say we all we got.
Raising five kids alone was very hard, stressful, sad place to be.
I thought nobody in my family loved me.
We are dysfunctional. Yes, we are.
It's mainly you.
It's mainly you.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
I'm a teen mom. I'm living in foster care. I don't really have my life mapped out the way I want it to be. I experience adversity the same way other people experience adversity. But I make the choice to see it as an obstacle and not as a roadblock that I can't move.
Uh-oh, the baby's sad.
Why are some children so damaged by early adversity, while others are able to thrive? Ernest Hemingway had a powerful way of addressing this question in A Farewell to Arms, where he wrote, "The world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are strong at the broken places." Yvonne Gross raised her five children in one of the poorest neighborhoods in Boston.
I get that feeling all the time, give it up. Like, if I give up, who will take care of my children? Nobody. Sometimes I get so stressful, I want to go hide underneath a rock.
5-year-old Bonnie, also known as Storm, was Yvonne's greatest concern.
He's starting to steal. 3 days ago, he got up, he was starting to hit himself in the face and whatnot. And I'm like, something's wrong here.
Is this the worst you've felt through all of this?
The worst? One time, I think I probably had a nervous breakdown one time. I just sat in the bathroom and cried, because there's no help.
It was rough. Very rough. You're always listening for bullies. My kids learned how to ride bikes and roller skate, jump rope in the house, because they had to learn when you heard them guns, you had to drop to the floor. It was rough. Bobby went through a rough time growing up. It was hard seeing him happen to struggle with me being a young mom, didn't understand, because the people around me said, your child is bad. So he got punished. I whooped his behind. He got even badder and angrier.
I tried hanging myself. I broke both of my arms. Only one got the scar. I laid under my bed and set my bed on fire. It's a battle wherever you go to fight to survive out here, and I'm still doing that every day.
Toxic stress is really the kind of adversity experienced by a child that is overwhelming, that the child cannot cope with his or her own behavior and physiology.
We're not talking about failing a test or losing a basketball game. We're talking about threats that are so severe, chronic, or pervasive that they literally get under our skin and change our biology.
In the early 70s, I was just going into college, and we just began to hear about this syndrome, post-traumatic stress, right? And soldiers were going off to Vietnam, and they were coming home, and they were changed, and they were ill physically and mentally ill. I thought, what if the war was in your home? It was on your streets, it was every time you went to school. What happened to you when you couldn't get off the front lines?
This clinic at Boston's Children's Hospital was created by one of the nation's most renowned pediatricians, Dr. T. Barry Brazelton.
Do you get tired?
I get tired. Very tired.
Are you hiding behind there? I don't think he wants me to see him. No, you don't like to be touched, do you?
No.
No. You don't like anybody to play with you?
No. No.
Bobby is one that I would say is going to cost society a lot if one made a prediction about him, because he's not only very hypersensitive. When I touched him, he jumped and moved away. If I tried to make any advance to him, he had to guard himself and shut me out right away. And he couldn't really let me get close. And that mother with five children under the age of six is so overwhelmed, she hasn't the capacity, the energy, the time, or anything else to pay attention to each of those children individually. So they have to really fight to get anything out of life. And that's what he's turned into, a fighter. A decent self-image comes from somebody paying attention to you as a person and respecting everything you do. If you pick up a small baby and the baby goes ooh at you and you go ooh back, and the baby says ooh a second time and you say that's right, and it goes ooh a third time, you say aren't you wonderful, that baby's face glows and you know that baby suddenly realized somebody loves me, somebody's passionately in love with me, and I know I'm worth it. Now, these kids probably never had much of that.
Bobby was in a mental hospital 20 times. Jail, I say 7 times.
That was a lot of trouble, Major.
Bobby, I need my chair. Could you go sit in your chair, please? Thank you.
Early adversity, really in many different forms, fundamentally affects the growth and development of the brain.
The basic way it works has to do with our body's fight or flight response, right? So imagine you're walking in a forest and you see a bear, right? Like what happens in our bodies? Immediately, the brain sends a signal to the rest of the body to release stress hormones. So we release hormones like adrenaline and cortisol. And these hormones are responsible for, you know, all those feelings that we have when we're terrified. That is what is supposed to happen to allow you to either fight that bear or run from the bear. But the problem is what happens when the bear comes home every night. Right? And this process is activated over and over and over again.
Hoping there's a future ahead for him instead of gang fighting and killing people.
I suspect that this was a mom who powerfully loved this little boy, Storm, but herself had become so injured by her own life experience that her ability to give the kind of serve and return that Barry Brazelton was referring to was limited by her own experience.
Thinking back on my own childhood, it was terrible. At 6 years old, we were molested constantly. We had no one to turn to. My biological mother didn't understand. She didn't care. She was told that's what happens. The state put me in DSS custody, and I was molested all over again.
If he was seriously neglected or abused or in a very violent environment or in a very tense and highly stressed home environment because of poverty as a baby, some of your brain circuitry, your metabolic systems, your cardiovascular system was affected early on in that very sensitive time in development. And there are biological memories of that. There are traces that are helping us now to understand why what happens early leads you to more likely have illness.
I had a stroke. I had 2 strokes. The first one left me wheelchair bound for 2.5 years. I had to battle cancer. Then here comes the the fibromyalgia, the chronic pain disorder, always in pain, always crying, can't get out of bed, can't walk. And then they told me that I had MS for years when I tried to take my own life. That was the lowest. And it was a sad, dark place.
When you have an adult who has an overactive stress response, they're more likely, that family is more likely to be in a stressful or traumatic situation. And the ability of the caregiver to be that buffer is compromised. And that creates a little bit of a perfect storm for intergenerational transmission.
My son Jeremiah has cerebral palsy. He can't talk, he can barely walk. I can't see him when I want to see him because his mother actually had both of our parental rights taken away. They basically said, I did everything. Beating on the kids, to showing them porn, to this, that, and the third, and all the blame went on me.
Families like Yvonne's family, where you see what happens to her, and then you see what happens to little Bobby, and you see this Nick, and then you see what happens to his kids, you add up those costs. I will tell you, we would have been much smarter to do an initial investment in solving that problem early on and making sure it did not go into the next generation.
There we go.
Yvonne and Bobby both rely on Social Security disability. The correlation between early adversity and poor health outcomes was documented in a landmark study called the Adverse Childhood Experience, or ACE study.
They asked 17,500 adults about their histories of 10 categories of adverse childhood experiences. And these include physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, physical and emotional neglect, or growing up in a household where a parent was mentally ill, substance dependent, incarcerated, where there was parental separation or divorce, or domestic violence.
There are 10 questions. So your ACEs score could be anything from 0 to 10. It's simply how many of these things actually happened to you. So if 4 of these things happen to you, your ACEs score is 4.
Yvonne's ACE score is 10.
For an individual with 4 or more ACEs, their risk for 7 out of 10 of the leading causes of death in the United States is dramatically increased. 7 out of 10. So when we are talking about the $3 trillion a year in healthcare spending that the United States is spending right now, 75% of which is for treating chronic disease, right? If we are not addressing ACEs as a root cause of chronic disease, we are missing the boat.
There's been great value from the ACE study that's shown how adverse experiences in childhood lead to problems in adult life. But an ACE score alone just gives you a measure of environmental exposure. It tells you nothing about individual differences in children.
Children have profoundly different responses to adversity. So the metaphor that we have ended up using for this, which seems to work both for scientists and for lay people, is this metaphor of the orchid and the dandelion. There are children who, like dandelions, can thrive almost in any environment in which they're reared. They do well even in conditions of stress and adversity. There are other children who are like orchids, who are extremely sensitive to the kind of environment that they're being reared in. Under the right nurturing conditions, they thrive almost better than any other child. But under conditions of adversity, under conditions of stress, they wilt and they don't do well.
20-year-old Daniela Anderson moved into her first group home at age 16 after being severely abused by her father. Since then, she moved a dozen times before ending up in a group home in Manhattan for pregnant girls in foster care.
I was pretty much decided that I was going to have an abortion, and I told my boyfriend, and he says, he can't. We're having this baby.
19-year-old Vesna Hover came to America from Cambodia after his parents were murdered when he was still an infant.
Why are you so anxious?
To have a family, Mom. I know we're gonna make this family work.
Just a few hours later, their son was born. Shortly after the birth, Daniela was forced to move into a mother-baby foster home.
I've never been so unhappy. Right now, I'm living out of garbage bags, and I don't feel like that's something I should have to do. I shouldn't have to wake up every other week in a new placement. I've been buying my own diapers, buying my own food, when foster parents are receiving money to do that for me. Vesna can't even come here to visit, and he needs to spend time with his child as well.
You got me looking like I'm soft, baby.
Oh, please. You got a little tweety thing on my shoulder.
Despite the turmoil in her life, Daniela continued taking classes at night at Hunter College.
I just knew when I had Elijah, I was going back to school. And I thought, despite the obstacles, I would make it.
I see a lot of confusion about...
No matter what, I'm getting to the other side, successful. At the core, I'm a dandelion. Because no matter what, I'm gonna make, you know, lemonade, like lemons, lemonade. Or lemon martini, I don't know, it depends on the day.
She is a poster child for a dandelion, okay? Which means that she can grow and thrive in lots of different circumstances.
There's something that clicks with me where it's like, okay, pity party over, now it's time to act.
How do you feel when you see pictures of your father?
I don't know. I get angry, I guess. My father, he hit us with 2x4s and literally anything he could pick up. My mother, she would sit back and allow him to do it because he would beat on her too. I used to get mad when my staff in my group homes would tell me, mothers, like animals in the wild, mothers protect their children, you know? And I'd say, well, my mother's not a mother because she never protected us, you know? My dad was just doing what he knew. Like, he knew, okay, well, a kid's not behaving in our culture, unfortunately, you know, it is taught, like, you know, you just beat them into submission. The final time was when he had hit me and I started bleeding from my head. That was what led to me being in foster care. I scored a 9 on the adverse childhood questionnaire, primarily because of the experiences I had with my parents and then subsequently when I went into foster care. So it was just a compounding of neglect, abuse, both physical, mental, sexual.
This is a tough thing to come out of unscathed. And the question of what is it about individuals who seem to overcome that? And there are some very clear findings that have come across all of these different contexts. At the top of the list is always the presence of some kind of supportive relationship.
From birth to age 5, the most important person, I would say for me, was my grandfather. He was loving and attentive, gave us nicknames, but more importantly, he always made me feel like no matter what, he would support me.
Sometimes it only takes one person. It only takes one person to teach a child how to feel safe and how to regulate themselves to make a difference in that child's entire future.
He loved us like, you know, to the moon and back. Like, we could tell.
You're happy too, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm happy, Mommy.
Daniela and Vesna voluntarily left the foster care system and moved into their first apartment in Connecticut.
Hi, Elijah. Hi.
Thank you.
pay rent in, wow, 3 days?
I hope I get this job, because then we won't have to worry about bills coming and we won't have any income coming.
We got bills already and we just moved in.
I guess my only fear is that one day that you're going to get in a big argument. You know, I guess that's my only fear, just to not be with you.
I think my biggest fear is repeating what my parents did to me with Elijah. Yeah.
It's gonna be a struggle, but we can do it as long as we do it together.
This was Vista and Daniela's wedding day. The ceremony was supposed to have started 2.5 hours earlier, but Daniela had not arrived. There were also serious doubts about whether Vesna would make it to the wedding. The night before at his bachelor party, Vesna got so drunk that he passed out and wound up in the emergency room on life support systems.
Here I am, the day before my wedding, wondering, am I getting into something that I'm gonna regret?
By virtue of the authority vested in me by the state of Connecticut, I do pronounce them husband and wife. You may kiss the bride.
After the wedding, Vesna and I happily introduced another member to our family. So now we have 2 children, Elijah and Sky. Shortly thereafter, he joined the military, and through those years, one of the things that happened was an abuse of alcohol, which then led to an abuse of everyone in the family. So there were rage-fueled pushing and fighting and shoving, and you know, I certainly didn't want that for me, and I definitely didn't want it for my children. One of the last big altercations that happened was when Elijah got into a fight with Vesna defending me and had Elijah on the floor, and he was literally choking him. And their version of Child Protective Services on post came to the house. And it really scared me. The fear of my kids being put into foster care made me realize, like, I have to go. And I ended up going to a domestic violence shelter. My greatest fear was repeating the same cycle for my children. And when I looked at them and I realized, like, they were going through what I saw and what I went through in my parents' dysfunctional relationship, it really made me wake up. I'm not helpless. I'm stronger than that. I shouldn't allow anybody to treat me like that, and certainly not someone who says they love me.
For young people growing up who have overcome these obstacles, they see a world that is filled with peril. You know, you might have gone through the swamp and the alligators didn't get you. But you don't forget you got to go through the swamp again. And those alligators didn't go anywhere. So you're going to think, you know what? I'm still vulnerable and I still got, you know, this child I have to provide for. And I'm uncertain and there's no guarantee of success.
The alcohol abuse got to the point where he was drinking and driving all the time. That led to this one evening where he got a DUI. So they did a other than honorable discharge. He's still the father of my children. And I still see him as a man who's experienced things that I couldn't fathom. Experience having my parents killed and then go to a refugee camp and then be put with this woman who was physically abusive to me and then taken away by, you know, Child Protective Services after making this trek across the world to a new country and not speak the language and then be put in foster care and, you know, to have to like go through all of that and then be brave enough to say, okay, all right, I'm gonna try having a marriage and then have a marriage and then join the military and go to a war zone to experience killing and having to like literally fight to survive. One of those situations could have made someone say, you know what, I'm gonna be an alcoholic.
In individuals who have experienced high doses of adversity in childhood, It affects the structure and function of the pleasure center of the brain. And so these folks actually get less pleasure from activities that should be pleasurable, and they need higher and higher doses to get the same effect. And what we see is that that's part of the reason why we see a dramatically increased risk for high-risk behaviors and substance dependence in individuals who have high doses of childhood adversity.
It meant him self-medicating with the alcohol and staying out and, you know, that kind of thing, and me self-medicating with, well, I'm not feeling loved and attended to and cared for, so I'm gonna eat. If Issa and I got in an argument, it would be like, okay, well, come on, kids, let's go to get ice cream. I could have easily been 600 pounds, easy. Between every adversity I've been through in my whole life, I decided no more was I, you know, gonna be like a victim to this. Like, I was gonna A, take off the weight, and then B, keep it off. I lost 40 pounds in like 4.5 months with Weight Watchers, and my leader, she said, I think you can help a lot of people who have been through this. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Daniela. I am a leader, I am a mother, I'm a student, and I'll be leading a workshop for you today on group facilitating and coaching. Do you like vegetables?
Yes.
Yes. So, what kind of vegetables do you like?
Spinach.
Spinach, okay. Can you guys see what we've created here? Yes, you see the shape?
A web.
It is a web, yes.
She is the quintessential example of a resilient person. But here's what science would say about that. She wasn't born inevitably to be resilient, but she was born with a lot of genetic potential to be more on the resilient side of things. Lucky for her.
I hate the word resilient because I think it takes away from the effort and energy and choices someone makes to overcome an obstacle.
Bring him close to you.
I'm raising a child that's going to be successful.
So I read your essay.
Mm-hmm.
Can I read you something?
I'll tell you my favorite line.
Not respecting oneself is the worst sickness. It feels as if your insecurities are gnawing at you, clawing its way out.
Wow. Where did that come from?
Again, late at night, most creative part of myself.
I feel like as a parent, I have a charge to really nurture my children and cultivate their spirits and make them feel like they can do anything and that they, you know, have the support from me, both physically, mentally, emotionally, you know, spiritually even.
I think she's also seen me as a woman, as a mother, be tenacious. So I think her feeling comfortable to model that behavior is different than Elijah. And when Elijah was living with me, he rebelled. It came to the point where he wanted to drink and he wanted to smoke cigarettes. So it became, well, that's why I want to live with Dad, because Dad's going to let me do what I want to do. And so now he lives with his father.
That story is another wonderful illustration of the ways in which no two children are actually raised in the same family. Every child in a given family has a different experience that depends upon birth order. It depends upon genetics. It depends upon the kinds of stressors encountered by the family during that child's critical period of early life.
Danny and Raymond Jacob lived in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, with their grandmother, Ursulina.
Thank you. Always know who the gentleman is around here.
They were abandoned by their biological mother when she became addicted to drugs.
Me and Raymond be in the room, sitting down, relaxing. He asks me a lot. He like, Dee, when we're gonna be a family again? And sometimes I don't know what to say, or I can say, just pray, right?
Danny and Raymond's mother had a family reunion at her drug rehabilitation program. Danny and Raymond's mother left the drug rehab program sooner than the family expected.
Where did you go? when you left there?
Oh, wait, my God.
I feel like everything I prayed for and hoped for is gone again.
Mommy, I feel that I'm never gonna be able to stop being high. Just being away in the programs for months is not gonna change me. And I don't feel like I wanna live anymore. I wish that I was just dead and my kids would be fine. And that's it.
When you was in the rehab, we was like, yeah, Grandma, my second year in high school, I'm living with my mother. We won't have to worry about it. We crack jokes and everything our second year. And now it's not gonna be no second year. Keep saying the same thing, nothing's happening. All these years, that's what Grandma talks about. All the chances they gave me. I'm tired of this.
I think it was a couple weeks ago, it was fun about like, to see if my mother was gonna come on his class trip. And then one of my friends had said, if my mother wanted to come. And I said, nah, she can't make it, she worked. Everybody else has like a mother, and that I have a mother, but my mother isn't being a mother.
Imagine if your mother, actually when you were a kid, was expressing through her behaviors that she did not want you. That damage that's done to a child will last with them for the rest of their life.
Yeah, we good.
Try to beat the coach, let's go.
The Underdogs basketball team been around since 2003.
6 and 5 seconds.
I started with just my brother, 15 kids, and now we've grown to 1,050 players.
Go hard. Gain speed, no spinning.
When my brother offered me the assistant coach job, I said, sure, why not? I just wanted to give back to my community and to a program that taught me so much throughout my year.
I wish we would have ran a cut a little bit harder and finished a little bit stronger, but that's what we're going to work on our offense now. Ready for offense? Yeah. Coach, let's get one more basketball.
Basketball saving.
Gentlemen, let's work on our A game.
I used to shoot and throw the ball at the rim, you know, just thinking about my mom and trying to erase what I was feeling. So a lot of these guys come to me, they just want to make it. They want a safe place to grow at. I try to provide that for them.
There's two types of players. What are they? Which one are you? Good, let's work.
They're coming from poor, broken homes, and foster care and messed up situations. And when you come out here in a ball court, you got guys coming from the same backgrounds that I grew up with.
You can instill something that nobody did for me, which was give me some hope on that basketball court. I was accepted. No matter what I was going through, didn't matter on the basketball court. It was when I walked off that everything started to really eat at me. So I just got, you know, focused and determined on my goals to get become a good basketball player. And I did that, got myself to college, got myself able to play, you know, coming from a high school that they didn't think the skinny guy would make it, and he did. I've come from nothing. I'm coming from no silver spoon, no support, no background. And I kind of want to be able to really, really change lives immediately, right off the top. From the moment I feel like they're worthy, I want to change it. So that's what I'm fighting for, man.
He wants a legacy. You want the statue and a high school named after.
Yeah, I'm
trying to stay modest.
And yeah, I'm on it, man.
My brother, he was basically the father figure, you know, taught me the ropes, taught me about the females and how hard work pays off. And he was definitely the role model. And he was more like a father figure for me my whole life.
You know, listen now.
Now, I'm a little bit more stubborn because, of course, I want to find my own way.
We was each other's pillar of strength. We didn't really, you know, and that's what I focused on as a young man, and, you know, was making sure I was all my brother needed. And as he came of age, it's thank God he felt the same way. He wanted to be the same way for me. So it was always us against the world. We kept our bond tight.
Ursulina reported to the family court to proceed with the seemingly inevitable adoption.
inform the court that we're going to put in a petition to terminate the mother's rights today.
What happens when you do that?
Once the package goes in, we come back to court, and she has a right to come to court and fight for her rights.
Okay, the bad news is your mother didn't show up. That's the bad news.
She
wants. Yeah, well, this is the question you got to ask your mother.
Raymond, I could not face them saying that they was going to take you from me. I had my clothes ready and everything. My friend woke me up this morning, but I just couldn't do it. I couldn't go. But you see how I pray God is on my side. He gave me another chance, right?
What do you mean by you couldn't get up and go?
Yeah, I didn't go to court.
Why?
Because I didn't want to hear them take you from me.
What are you talking about? You were scared. You were supposed to be there and tell them you don't want them to take your kids. Yeah.
All right, now this is Sam. Me and Mamie, this got us thinking. I'm like, do she want us? The judge is saying, no, maybe she doesn't because she's not here. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, I don't know what else to say. You say you do, but you're not showing us.
I do want you guys, don't say that.
I have to say that you need to hear that. So you have no way of winning, so just throw on the towel. It's over, game over. Just that you're younger than me and you don't have your moms. And I don't think it's fair to you that you missed out on that.
You said that. Family will always be there, and friends will come and go. And I still feel that way. And you know, family go too. Like they do die somehow. Everybody's gonna go. But you can always hold them in your heart. And you know, that's a place where I'm gonna have to keep mommy.
Danny is just crying. Raymond looks like he's not crying. He looks like he's trying to say, well, you know, I can deal with this. No, you can't. You can't deal with this at 8 or 7 or 9. This is emotionally devastating. And if you don't get help, it's liable to pay, you know, a huge role as you move forward in life.
Midway through my high school career, I started suffering with manic depression, bipolar disorder, and from the ages of 14 to 19, I was hospitalized 12 times, and it just took a toll on me.
To have something like that happen is absolutely horrible, horrible. You know, I mean, it was, you can't put in words as a brother to not be able to protect your own brother. That was the hardest part, just not being able to protect somebody you love.
For the past 6 years, I've been receiving disability, and it's a blessing.
I think it's interesting that it was the younger boy, Raymond, who in subsequent life went on to have far more in the way of mental disorder and difficulties than his older brother. That may have to do with differences in genetics, but it may also have to do with the period of life, the period of development during which the stressor of their mom becoming addicted and going to a treatment program and being absent from the family occurred.
Second.
I began to realize that the research that we were doing regarding these children who differ in susceptibility to the stress of the environment was really an echo of my own childhood. We grew up in a family where there was lots of conflict. My sister, Mary, began developing a series of mental health symptoms that ultimately led to a diagnosis of schizophrenia. And she actually ended up taking her own life several years ago. The story of the Orchid and the Dandelion are really the story of my sister and me. Whereas I, the older brother and the more dandelionish of the two of us, was able to sustain and move through those challenges to my own development and life, my sister was really relatively unable to do that. There were probably genetic vulnerabilities for both Raymond and for my sister that were there and were very real, but may not have expressed themselves without the impact of those early experiences.
I'm really impressed at how
gracious and healthy.
We have this general understanding in pediatrics that children living in very threatening environments are at greater risk for health problems, but we've had no way to screen for that. And we're close to being able to screen for them.
You see that?
Yeah.
She really wants to walk.
We will have measures to be able to differentiate children who seem to be more sensitive to adversity and therefore need more attention. And at the same time, this will be a measure of resilience, because there are a lot of children living in very tough environments who are doing well and whose parents are doing a magnificent job. That's the big breakthrough. It's being able to measure this at an individual level. Simple EEG, a measurement of electrical activity in the brain, put a little cap on a child's head, a couple of minutes to get an EEG tracing. It will tell you about the electrical activity in the brain, which in cases of stress can also be decreased.
Oh, it's all good. You look really good.
Yeah.
All right.
So we're interested in understanding how babies react to the different experiences that they have. And the way we do this is by recording her brain activity by wearing this special hat. And then while she's wearing it, she'll watch a movie and we'll get to see what's going on in her brain.
This is bringing 21st century neuroscience into the community setting in a pediatric office where people can interpret this. And it's a whole new world. There's signs of excessive stress effects. And we can measure these in simple ways. You can look at stress hormones like cortisol. These are things that you can collect in urine. You can collect them in saliva. So they'll be very simple to do in a community-based setting.
So the next thing we'll do is we do a urine collection from him. And the way we do that, we just ask you to help us with a regular diaper change. And what we're looking for in here is a marker called isoprostanes. And so that is a marker of oxidative stress and has been associated with some health issues later on. All right, fantastic. Almost done.
This possibility of screening, it's a game changer for moving from just talking about toxic stress to measuring it.
If this becomes standard of care in pediatricians' offices, they have perhaps one of the most powerful tools ever to identify children at risk for exposure to excessive stress, to know whether or not children are living in excessively stressful circumstances, and to measure whether or not they're getting better from the interventions that we provide.
What did you want it to be before you wanted to be a singer and a writer?
A doctor.
Okay. Take a deep breath.
This early intervention program called Healthy Steps now operates in 120 pediatric clinics in 15 states.
The overarching goal of Healthy Steps is to take advantage of the primary care pediatric practice as a universally accessed practice and as a trusted setting. So now when you bring your child to the pediatrician, you see the pediatrician and the Healthy Step specialist. And that Healthy Step specialist pays extra attention to the parent-child relationship, to the attachment status between the parent and the child, to the parent's own mental health.
So Carmen, we've talked a lot about some of the things that you went through when you were a little girl that have made it really hard to feel like the world is a safe place.
I was raped as a little girl, and my mom never really did anything about it. When I was 11 years old, I was sent away to a mental institute because he repeatedly did this to me, and my mom, I guess she didn't know how to take care of me the same way that I didn't know how to take care of my daughter.
I think it was hard for you to trust your mommy instinct, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
We try to identify families at risk as early as humanly possible. They might still be pregnant. We don't have to wait until the baby's here, or they might have a newborn. And then if they want to be part of the program, what that means is that the Healthy Step specialist will co-manage every single visit to the pediatric practice.
I became so consumed with hurt and anger and hate and frustration that when I finally had my daughter, I guess it escalated through the postpartum depression as well, where I just felt at times even that I didn't even want to exist anymore. And Healthy Step helped me in that sense of, you know, me knowing how to speak to my daughter, how to let her know that I'm not shutting you out, because I believe that's what I was doing at first.
And with Serenity, no matter what happens to her, big or small, she knows that she can go to her mommy.
Absolutely.
And her mommy is going to take her seriously and protect her and stand up for her.
I make sure that my daughter knows that I will always listen to her.
Mm.
I feel like I am the mother that I was born to be.
The costs of inaction on early childhood are so severe. And in the big budget that has so many zeros behind it, when I say to you that we do this for $450 per family per year, those are pennies.
This preschool program is part of the Harlem Children's Zone, which has been led by Jeffrey Canada for three decades.
Today we've got 13,000 kids in our program. We've got more than 25,000 adults who are part of the services we provide. We've got kids that we start with those parents when their kids are 1, 6 months, sometimes when the parent is pregnant. And we're trying to make sure that we prevent as many of those initial challenges that parents face that end up interfering with the development of their child. So what happens 20 years later? This is what we find. 95% of our kids graduating high school. Out of that graduation rate, about 95% of those kids going on to college, that they graduate college at higher rates, both in four-year schools and two-year schools, than every other ethnic group, including whites in America. But here's some things we don't talk about. We have way reduced teen pregnancy rates, and numbers that you would have assumed, 300-400 kids were in jail. We had one.
Now we actually understand and can see and can measure how early adversity impacts risk of health and behavior problems over the lifetime. And we can connect that to the economic cost of inaction, right? So we can either pay this tremendous cost for not doing anything about the situation, or we can invest in prevention.
Folks will come in and say, Jeff, but yes, you're spending $5,000 on that child. Could we scale that? And I have said to folks, when you begin to calculate what we end up spending on families, that we don't provide really effective interventions, we don't solve the problems early on, there's the incarceration cost. The latest New York City cost to incarcerate one person in New York City for a year, $167,000. Those costs seem to me to be really not scalable, but you know what? We scaled them all over America. Then you throw on top of that all of the losses and tax revenues from folks who are not going to be able to go to work. Their work experience is going to be cut short. If you care about national defense, have a healthy population. Have kids who are growing up who can read, who can write, who will be able to work for their entire adult lives. That's really, to me, national security.
Where is Bobby? Where is Bobby?
Here I am.
The story of Storm and his family is just one little postage stamp example of the economic impact of these kinds of experiences on children and on society writ large.
Each time a new baby is born, we are given another chance to do better and improve the likelihood of a better outcome for this child. I mean, for a lot of people, for me, that's compelling reason enough to do it. But for some people, and I welcome a big tent on this, for some people for whom the issue is much more about the financial cost to society, every time a new baby is born is always another chance to save more money.
So much of the talent that young people have is absolutely destroyed and sometimes limited because they did not get the kind of support, emotional, intellectual, educational support when they were children. So would Daniela have been the next Supreme Court judge if she had a stable mom? We don't know. I celebrate what she's done with her life, but I also recognize that there's a certain, I think, toughness, determination, and grit that these folks have, that if they had given, had been given even a small amount of support, boy, what they may have accomplished.
I'm not a millionaire and I don't, you know, plan on becoming a millionaire working where I work, but I feel fulfilled and I feel like there's tons of people with tons of money that are unhappy, so if I had to trade, I wouldn't.
I believe that we have a truly ethical, moral obligation to care for those in our midst that are the most troubled, the most needy, and those are our children.
If you look at what's happening to families where you have opioid addiction and the impact that has on children. I mean, it's very clear you could see it with those two boys growing up with that mom who was on drugs. This is just not in the inner cities. With black and brown kids, that's happening all over America right now. This is a fairly significant group of kids in this country that without real interventions, they simply are not going to be able to reach their full potential.
Me and my brother always jokingly say, you know, that if my mother was there, he would probably be in the NBA and I probably would have been a doctor, a lawyer. We would have been two different people.
So, at the Harlem Children's Zone, we haven't made it so these kids don't have problems. What we've made it is that they can escape. No matter what happens, there's a group of people here that have known you your entire life. If something happens with the family, there's still a group of folk who become this alternative support group that believes in you, that tells you, you know, that they're going to stick with you, that they're going to help you navigate. It doesn't replace mom. It doesn't replace that love. What it does is it gives you a stability that says maybe there's a way to make it out of this and still end up okay.
I'm optimistic because potentially we finally have some hard science to support what every grandparent and kindergarten teacher has always told us, that this is an incredibly important time, that you can make long-lasting changes for these kids, and we can finally potentially measure it, is, I think, the breakthrough that we've all been waiting for.
I'm incredibly hopeful because number one, when we understand it as a public health crisis, it allows us to use the right set of tools, right? It allows us to use public health level tools, raising awareness, doing routine screening, doing early detection, investing in systems for intervention, right? And that is how you solve a public health crisis. And in the US, we're actually pretty good at that. But the second thing is that when we talk about two-thirds of the American population who has at least one adverse childhood experience, for me, that means that there is none of us are more than one degree of separation from this problem. And that means we're all invested in finding solutions. That is the power that we have to come together, because anyone who has experienced ACEs in their life wants to be part of easing suffering for others.
All right. So we'll spend a few minutes having a little bit of a discussion. Just what resonated with you?
I like the dandelion orchid analogy, you know, just think about, you know, think about the people who I know who have who have had backgrounds like that, and to think about them in as a dandelion, where you know they have, you know, some of the students that I have, you know, that are, you know, when they talk about what their background is and here in school, they've got things that, you know, something internal in them, as well as the support around them. So I really like that example. That analogy.
Mm-hmm. My reaction is that it's very daunting. This is about the children that we're able to reach in 2018 and hopefully more in 2019, but there's got to be so many more. And what I'm thinking about is, again, the scalability is how do we create systems of support that would reach many, many, many more. It's kind of like an interfamily partnership. You know that the impact on those that are tested is huge, but the caseload is limited. And is there a way to do something different about the model, about this model that we just saw, that could make it more effective to larger groups of people?
I feel like intervening or supporting when moms are pregnant or when they, you know, have their baby, that's such a huge opportunity, because all these moms, both in the documentary but also what I hear from moms, you know, in my own practice, is they want to be good parents. They don't want to repeat the mistakes of their parents. And I feel like that is such a powerful time to intervene. But yeah, I mean, I think speaking to how do you do that on a systems-wide level?
Well, it was just recently that there was a meeting that was held, too, is within the last 3 or 4 months, organized by self, and I think the county and different, we're looking at children's mental health needs. It was while the legislature was going on still. And at that point, and the ESB was involved, the people that were at that meeting declared that we have a child care crisis in this community. And it is so obvious that nobody sees it. And we talked about this at SELF, you know, how do we bring the issues of kids to the forefront in, you know, business and every place that we look. That, and it's not just poor kids. It's not just kids that are... you know, of different races or ethnicities. It could happen to any kid. And it's so obvious, but we don't see it. We just don't see it. We just, you know, it's, you know, our tagline itself is our children can't wait. We just keep, you know, 5,000-6,000 babies are born a year in Clark County, and what percentage of those kids, only about 40% of kids are in any kind of organized child care. I mean, the other babies, you know, and it costs as much for infant care as it does to go to UW for a year. And so, you know, there's the cost burden, there's the, and then the kids, the children that aren't in child care, they passed like a football here, and that's just, you know, you just think about, that's going on in our community right now. And you know, we're just stressing, we're putting all this toxic stress on so many children, especially in low-income families.
So what do you think, you know, one of the things that I asked you to think about as you were watching the movie is, what can you do individually or within your organization or in your role as FACT to advise the Board of Health? Thinking about the topics that we've been really focused on, or we're focusing on this year, is suicide prevention.
We need a revenue stream to support. Mm-hmm. That's the bottom line. Is that's what we're working on, you know, with our partners. We need a revenue stream to deal with, you know, to identify one or two of those gaps and to focus on it to make a difference. And it's I just came from a SELF board meeting this morning. I mean, we're doing our strategic planning. This is such a complex problem, and we can't fix it all at once. We have to narrow it down and do something with maybe one group of kids, and just, But there's got to be a revenue stream. There's got to be some kind of a public revenue stream where we value our kids, and we, whether it's supporting, you know, helping families afford childcare, whether it's getting more, you know, childcare right now. I mean, the idea in the legislature, they said, well, we've upped it to 55%. How many people would open a business and say, well, we're going to get, if it costs you a dollar to do business, we're going to give you 55 cents. That's the way we fund childcare, public childcare in the state. We at 55 cents. We have to be giving 100%, 100%.
So how do you?
So we have to clearly define the multiple problems. Mm-hmm. There's the mental health issues, there's the cost issues, there's the access to childcare issue, there's parenting issues, there's a whole a range of topics that contribute to the problem, and we can't fix them all at once. It's too complex, it's too big.
I did like how they had kind of a partnership between a pediatrician doctor and a community partner. Mm-hmm. And I think that you can't have your pediatrician do everything, because just like with any, you know, appointment, you've got so many different things to cover, mm-hmm. that they don't have the time to go through that. So that partnership that they talked about, and I don't know if that can become more, you know, normal, is that you have that ability, and especially also the stress markers that they were actually able to measure. I thought that was really key too, is that they can sometimes cue in, even the mom may not say anything, and that's, you know, there's a shame associated with that, with mothers, and trying to do the best thing, and they're not going to always talk about it, they're trying to do the best they can. So if you can sometimes mark some of these kids, is that these kids are stressed out for whatever reason there may be, and more digging needs to happen. I felt like that was a good, and it doesn't sound like it was a very difficult test, and so kind of getting those testing mm-hmm. more available to pediatricians or to the partnership is great. You've got somebody else that, you know, the pediatricians are not always totally trained in all the different aspects of what those families are going through, and also maybe know what assistance that can be provided from that family depending yes. on what they need to. So.
Well, at one point in time, didn't we have one of our physician interns that was working on getting the ACEs universal screening in our pediatrician offices? How far did that go?
We had a grant for a while, yeah. but it goes uh-huh. back to funding, where we were working on with different pediatrician offices to see if they would be willing to do some ACEs screenings in the pediatric office. And it was great, and we had a good reception. However, it goes back to exactly what you were just saying, which is, okay, I screen for it, but then what? What can we provide them? What do I do for this family when I recognize that there's toxic stress here? What do we do? So that goes back to kind of what you were saying, Joan, is that there's certain gaps in our system that we really have to address in order to really look at this in a systematic and a holistic way. Which is challenging, because your role as FAC, I mean, you advise the Board of Health. I think part of the role is making sure that our board is aware and educated on this issue. So as they're starting to look at policy and different improvements and funding, they understand that, because they're not just funding public health, they're funding all kinds of things within our community. So mm-hmm. how do we, mm-hmm.
I'm just ahead. Thinking from an organizational perspective. I mean, one of the biggest roadblocks to, you know, for example, like we want to hire social workers, we want to have therapists, but the biggest roadblock is the funding. Mm-hmm. You know, social workers don't generate as much revenue as a cardiothoracic surgeon does. So from a systems-wide perspective, you know, we hear about developers getting tax breaks to build huge condos and apartment buildings. Well, how about maybe, you know, tax breaks for organizations that are doing this kind of work by bringing in these community partners or social workers and looking at outcomes and rewarding organizations who want to do this, providing that incentive to do that. Just thinking about in my own clinic, you know, that would, I think, spur leadership to say, maybe we should look into hiring social workers to, you know, take advantage of this. I mean, I think with managed care plans, you know, we're kind of moving a little bit towards that with insurance, mm-hmm. where you're looking at quality and not just the quantity, you know, doctor's visits, but from a more system-wide perspective. I mean, that's one way I would think that in terms of the revenue stream, we're incentivizing, you know, these kinds of programs would help.
I was just thinking in my head, this is in wind and solar energy, and he talks a lot about the renewable energy tax credit, and that's what powers places like Microsoft to decide that they're going to buy a bunch of renewable power. I mean, renewable power is expensive, but it's, you know, they have to have purchase it through. So it's just, that's kind of what you're saying, is that it can have that tax credit based on the benefit, the potential benefit, the potential good of getting off of some of those.
So what you made me remember was the way our healthcare system is constructed is it really does rely a lot on the very highly trained and highly paid, one would hope, for their training, professionals. And there's not enough of them. And you can't, pediatrician can't do everything. Mm-hmm. And I worked with a doctor named Eric Coleman. Have you ever heard of him? Back in the day, he worked a lot on Wagner's model of chronic care, but he worked on this thing where he had advanced practice nurses that worked as coaches for people that were discharged from the hospital to help them to thrive at home and not get readmitted right away, which is a very expensive proposition. And I was doing a study with him in Bellingham, and I remember asking him, I said, these advanced practice nurses, they just can't take care of that many people. But what if we had like a layperson that was trained to ask the same questions, it's all a script, could they intervene and reach more people? It would be way less cost. And now we have community health aides, or I can't remember the proper term, community health workers. Is there a role for more lay people that could be trained to specifically address things that we know can help, like parenting skills, stress busters, and various different things like that? So that's one of the things that comes to my mind, because it will take such a long time if we rely only on our current system of care to reach the number of people that we would need to actually experience a significant difference.
So one of the things you just brought up, Joan, I think you mentioned your family partnership. So one of the things that we're actually doing now is we were able to use some of the mental health sales tax dollars to bring in some, not only additional nursing care, because we need more nurses, but we were able to hire a community health worker that's actually working on, and it's a little bit different than how the model is set up. So we're doing this pilot study, and we're with the blessing of Dr. Olds, who founded Nurse Family Partnership, you really want to see exactly that. How you sort of take off from the back of the person who's providing that clinical nursing care, take off those administrative kinds of functions. Because the way the model is, you know, and the way the model is in many cases in clinical care, the nurse, the practitioner, is actually doing all of these things. Do they really need to do that? Is there an opportunity for someone to do some of those other things? So what we're having the community health worker do is exactly that. They're taking, the nursing provides the screening, but then they're taking the data, they're entering it into the system, they're helping to navigate care. If we find that a family needs, you know, whatever it is they need to look into housing, they need to look at all, you know, some, you know, they need to be connected to a care provider. Our community health worker is now helping with that kind of navigation. So we just started down this road. We just hired this person a month and a half ago. We're starting to collect that data, but that's exactly right. Is we've got to figure out how to scale this in a way that, you know, even though Nurse Family Partnership tends to be an expensive program, mm-hmm. when you look at it, when you look at the downstream cost savings, mm-hmm. that they were talking about in the film, it's enormous. And so being able to, though, provide the data that actually shows that, I think, is really, really important. And being able to let the nurses do what they do best is also very important. So that's an example of something that kind of what you're talking about.
That's an interesting model, and the fact that some of the biggest stressors for families that are having stresses finding out where they go get housing or where they get transportation, and they're sent here, there, and yon. And they have to take the kids with them, and they have to figure out how to get there. And that in itself and navigating the system is a big stressor right there. So coming up with a model like that that kind of puts it in a one-stop shop in a sense, I mean, they still may have to go different places, but if they can make it easier for them, that's one less stressor for them to have to face.
And that's what BridgeView is all about.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, one-stop shopping, that was what it's...
And I think there's lots of agencies out there that try to help in all of those avenues, but it's finding them sometimes and navigating a system, and they just sit at home going, I can't figure it out, and I've got the, like the woman on the show, you know, I've got five kids, I just can't do it, you know? So I think models like that are very, very helpful.
BridgeView.
So I think one of the bigger challenges is actually a little bit further upstream, and the fact that there's really not community awareness surrounding this at all. Mm-hmm. And until you can get the community to understand toxic stress, which I think actually resounds better than ACEs even, then it's hard to get the funding that you need. It's hard to get the programs that you want to put in place. I think that's the bigger challenge, is being able, you have something now that you can point to and say, here's what this is. And it doesn't take very long to say, oh, I've seen that. But I didn't realize that that's what that was. So you have to kind of put a name to it and then work on your awareness program, and then you can attack the legislature and all that once you've done that community education piece. And I think that's where the huge gap is right now.
Well, I know in Battleground, and Bob, I'm going to pick on you for a little bit. You did a great presentation with the joint meeting we had with Board of Health. But that's exactly what you're talking about, is some of the work that's going on in Battleground right now around ACEs. And what have you, I mean, from your perspective, from law enforcement representative, how have you seen that this information has helped the community out there?
It's been a couple of years, and I just remember when we first started, we did a lot of training, not only for police officers, we did training for school staff, school teachers. We went into the medical, some of the medical Vancouver Clinic places like that, and taught, you know, ACEs and explained what everything was. For us, I think it helped us delve into other areas, like that's how we started doing our restorative justice and our school-based diversion, knowing that, okay, if we don't arrest kids, we don't handcuff them, we don't transport them back to juvenile hall, and we can intervene early, that's one less ACE we have to, you know, we're not adding ACEs onto them. And I've been listening to what everybody's been saying, and part of it is, it's the same thing we're doing now with the juvenile justice system, is we want incarcerating people is too expensive. And I'm on our jail committee, so as a doctor, we know that, hey, we can build a jail as big as we want to. You know, we can arrest as many people, we can fill it up, and as long as there's, you know, a lot of money, we can build it, you know, keep adding on to it. But we also know that there's a limited amount of money, and we don't want to do that. So I think in the same way that you're talking about, we want to do with people that are going to be arrested, release them on bail, or people that are sentenced, but they don't necessarily have to go into the jail, is to have the same kind of thing, some kind of caseworker that they're assigned, it follows them through and helps them get the resources they need. And I kind of see what you're saying there, that it's almost like, and I say the same thing all the time, it's all interrelated. It doesn't matter if it's school-related issues, they're not doing well in school, they don't do their homework, the police are getting called to their house, we're arresting people all the time, people are sick all the time. But at the end of the day, when you step back and look at it all, it's movies like this to tell you that it really is all integrated. And we all have our little silos, but we also, I think the best thing that happened out of this whole thing as we're having these conversations today that we didn't have 5 years ago. And I try to explain it to our officers. When officers say, hey, you know, this family's got all these issues, and I really need to sit down with them, and you know, we call it community policing now, but really trying to sit there and say, okay, who can I pick up a phone, who can I call to help facilitate, get this family what they need? And the problem is that, you know, you wish it was so organized where you could just fill out, tap into a computer, push a button, it went to somebody, they did everything for you. And we're not there yet, but, you know, what that is, I don't know. I think, you know, part of it, I think, is insurance companies are going to have to pick up some of the cost, because they're going to realize down the road that they're saving money. It doesn't matter if it's medical insurance or, you know, the homeowner's insurance where, you know, something happens in the house, liability insurance. They're going to end up figuring out a way to figure out, hey, if we do X, Y, and Z, we save 20%. You know, so and the problem I see is the, I don't think that, and here's my personal belief, is we keep saying, well, we can't do anything until we get more public funding. I don't see that coming down the pipeline. Not in this day and age, but we have funding for nothing. You know, because if you look at our infrastructure falling apart, you know, our criminal justice system's falling apart, you know, the people don't have medical insurance. So I'm trying to figure out, okay, how can you make it work? And that's where, you know, I get frustrated, because you know, we have this, I deal with their emails every day, people reaching out. I guess another thing that's kind of probably good too is people even realize now in their families that, hey, because we hear it, you know, I start looking at all the ACEs that I have or my family has. We had those conversations 10 years ago or 15, 20 years ago. We didn't talk about it. If you had a bunch of ACEs in your household, you sure as heck didn't go and tell everybody about it, right? We do that now. And so I think that's a good question. The question is, what's the next step? And I like the idea of, you know, because the schools are involved, and the medical clinics are involved, your family doctor's involved, criminal justice system's involved, and we're all dealing with the same people. We may not know it because everything's so siloed and you can't share information, but when you start looking and digging and talking to people, offhand like we do here, when you start talking to medical professionals and the schools and stuff, it's the same families. We all know it is. And so those are the kinds of conversations we've had for years, and especially in the school realm. I remember when we first started talking about this whole thing, the big issue was all these laws that were to protect everybody's privacy were getting in the way of us trying our ability to provide services. Because you had, you know, the schools got their, you have medical people have HIPAA, the schools got their regulations, and everybody's trying to walk that line without violating anybody's privacy. But at the end of the day, I don't think it was doing us any good. And even to the families who wanted that. That's a long answer to a big question.
It's a long, it was an awesome answer. But I also think that it highlights what you've been able to do within your own organization.
Right.
So there's changes in your own organization. And that was another question that I wanted you to think about and maybe share, is that what can you do, you know, individually? I mean, I think they mentioned that it just takes one, you know, adult in a child's life that makes a difference. So that might be something we could do personally, is think about that. But also, what can you do within your own organization?
We were talking about that this morning, Roxanne. Yeah. That if we could, you know, Spokane has done something about resilience. They've got, and they're doing, and it's like, we are strong enough in our county that if we created some kind of a resilience campaign, a caring adult for every child, or some name where you begin to provide, because we know the evidence is powerful, to make sure every child knows that there's somebody that loves them and cares for them unconditionally. And there are a lot of kids that don't have that, or their parents don't know how to show it to them. But if we could make sure that, you know, if we as a community embraced an idea like that, a campaign to make sure one caring adult for every child or something like that, that's the direction we're going with our partners in early learning, is how could we create a program like that? You start it off, and how could we get the whole community invested? And I agree with what Dave says. There are still people that don't know what we're talking about. I mean, we think there is an increased talk level, but there are businesses that don't know about it. And I think this is where the work that's been going on by the ACEs Action Alliance and all the presentations that are going on, you know, at different businesses, at the chamber, et cetera, you know, that we've got to keep that up. It can't stop, because there are people that will say, I don't know what you're talking about. That's really interesting. It's raising, but it's certainly, we're talking to the choir here.
When you think about, like, the anti-smoking campaigns, right? I mean, they did something right. Mm-hmm. They were so successful. They managed to broaden the conversation how cigarettes are dangerous. And I mean, I don't know all the details of, you know, what is it about that worked. I mean, part of it could have been they had a lot of funding, you know, public health funding to do this. That would be interesting, I think, to look at is what helped that campaign work. And as I was watching the documentary, like, one of the things that really struck me is how powerful the individual stories are. I mean, it's one thing to have all the statistics and the experts and the PowerPoint slides, but when you hear the people who have been through this talk about, you know, ACEs and what really helped them build resilience, and I feel like that has to be a part of, you know, I mean, if they're willing to speak out, having those stories be a part of this conversation at the Board of Health or at public meetings, I think those are the stories that draw people in to really make it a community conversation and not, you know, something that is, you know, just in this room or with the experts.
And the contrasting side of that, I think, is important too, right? So the ones that are resilient, the dandelions. Mm-hmm. Who would have thought we need more weeds? I do. But you have to talk about the orchid side of it as well. Mm-hmm. And I think Bob's right as it relates to you really have to get the insurance companies involved, because ultimately what drives them is what's going to save their bottom line. You know? Mm-hmm. And you can go and do the actuarials and say, hey, this path ultimately is less expensive than this path.
I think sometimes the business argument is really effective with a lot of people, because they may not be, you know, oh, touchy-feely, this is touchy-feely stuff, right? Well, when you really look at the economics behind this, it's super powerful. It's a very, very powerful one.
Yeah, it is, and the business case is really has to look into the future, because for those who might be benefited or be harmed in the next couple, 3 years, they might not be that incentivized to really think that way. But in the bigger picture scheme of things, if you really do care about that business's health now and on into the future, that is the right way to think about it. And that's why you would do your business case based on a, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20, 30-year return on that investment. And another thing, so I'm doing a lot of brainstorming right now, but it has to do with, we have other successful programs, I think, anyway, way back to many years past, where children coming up into school, not being able to start kindergarten and not being able to learn how to read, and they and this huge campaign and recruited grandparents and other people that had time to come into the classroom and just read with kids. And it really made a huge difference, and it was a volunteer force. Mm-hmm. And I think and same thing with like the insurance issue. That's another super short-sighted way of thinking about how this is gonna work in terms of, you know, meeting the needs. This is a more short-term win, but they don't seem to get it. So I just think there's got to be a way to tap into, it would probably take many solutions in order to tackle such a big problem. But the window of opportunity in that person's life is very narrow. Mm-hmm. So if you can, you want to get there at that time and create a person who potentially could be a dandelion, even if, or an orchid, even if their situation's not going to change.
Well, while this is focused on early childhood, there's always, the great thing about this is that whether, you know, probably all of us in this room have A scores, an A score of 1 to 10, but I think you also have to look at that adults too can be benefited by policies that are made to be trauma-informed policy. So when we look at our own organizations and how we're dealing with people, I mean, I had a great conversation with the wastewater division, and what they were interested in looking at is how can they reach some of their customers and bring some programs to customers that they weren't taking advantage of for a number of reasons. How do they really reach these customers that are really, you know, the customers that are in poverty, that are, you know, that have some, you know, disabilities, that are, you know, that don't have transportation, all these issues. Well, when you look at it, a lot of those issues come from, you know,
growing up in an environment where you have, you know, high A scores, and then it ends up with these sort of chronic conditions. And so that's an example of an organization that's looking at how do we change our policies to be more trauma-informed, to understand that, so that we can help people in these situations really become more resilient, no matter what stage that they're at. So that's an example. But there's a variety of things, I think, that our community can do and that we really need to look at. With regard to the topics that we've been talking about, gun safety and suicide prevention, how did this resonate with you? How did this information resonate with you with regard to those topics? How did this information sort of dovetail with those topics?
The ultimate solution to suicide is, you know, if you look at as the ACE scores go up, the people who attempt suicide or are successful at suicide, it's like 500, I mean, I don't have the numbers right off, but they're staggering if you have a high ACE score, the people that will commit suicide or attempt suicide. And so a lot of the solutions are focusing, catching it early, supporting it so that people don't become, you know, that one woman said, you know, with the five kids, she considered taking her own life. I mean, it's...
Well, I think everybody in that film has a battle with suicide, and everybody in that film has some battle with some type of violence in their life. So they were worried about having violence happen. They all had some violence, and they all potentially, some, you know, even the mom said she was violent to her own kids, and so violence. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the flip side is just as crazy.
Well, people feel like there's no hope. I mean, that's one of the strongest predictors of suicide, is when people feel completely hopeless. And so these programs are hoping that's what they're doing, is they're giving these parents hope that there is something better for them and for their kids. And I think that goes a long way to reducing distress and suicide.
Interesting. I have a friend who has probably very, very high ACEs scores, extremely successful adult, and I've talked to her a little bit about ACEs, and I don't have a lot of friends with that high probably ACE scores, but I kind of asked her, like, what are you thinking? She was very, she is not very compassionate to people who don't do that, you know, so it's interesting because you'd think that she should be very compassionate, but she has really no, what's the word?
Empathy.
Yeah, she is. She's a federal law enforcement agent now, so she sees, like, people who really got paid.
There you go.
But she, it's interesting because she doesn't, I mean, I think she did have some of this, what makes her have the grittiness that it got her to where she is now. She's an attorney. I mean, she's got a great family and all those things, but she is very, she is not very compassionate, you know, just when you talk to her as a social person, I would think that she would be more empathetic to the situation, but some people, I think, are not.
But even the woman in the video or the movie was like, I don't like that word.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what made me think of her, too. It's like, she doesn't, she's like, I'm not resilient. I work my ass off, and I'm not going to take it down, and I don't want you, you know, because that this was my lot in life or my upbringing, I work through it, and it's because of me. It's not because of, I think there's certain things that obviously she had had that supported her through that, but it's interesting how she's pretty aggressively, like, you know, those people that are taking all the handouts, they could do better.
It made me think of, because I know someone like that too, they're very pick yourself up by your bootstraps.
Uh-huh.
I did
it.
I managed to do it.
Right.
I worked two jobs or whatever. But there was one of our high school representatives that was here, and we were talking about youth suicide, and she was like saying, yeah, you guys are putting a lot of effort into this, but you're really not speaking to where people are at that are really in this situation. And it just even the conversation made me think about that. Like, how do we support people? How do we develop these systems? And who's developing those systems? And are they informed by people who need those systems?
Exactly.
I think there's also shame around it, that even though I think we're getting better about talking about it, but people who are really have high ACE scores. I'm not so sure. I know someone who I believe has probably three high ACE scores. And she says she doesn't. Maybe she does. And I think that her current life experience would reflect that also. So I think there's just some reluctance on the part of people who know about ACEs. They probably know that they have high ACE score, but they don't want other people to know about it. So how do we get to those folks to help them as adults?
Mm-hmm. Well, we still think that if you have any kind of mental illness or behavioral health problem, it's a character flaw instead of a brain disease, you know, and so there's the whole issue of parity, you know, between physical and mental health or behavioral health that compounds that, you know, that people are embarrassed to say they have a mental illness of some kind and they're taking meds for it or whatever, because, I mean, some people will think that they are not as strong character as they could be.
Well, I thought it was really interesting because I think they highlighted that really well in the film, that people are different. People are different. And how they're going to react is different. And so we have to be thoughtful about how we are building systems to address those issues and address those differences. Because your friend might be fully resilient, whether we like that word or not, but she's great. She's going, she's doing her thing. But someone else may not, and so how do we help that person to achieve the same or to achieve success in their lives, whatever that looks like for them.
And then you just throw in a little bit of institutional racism and different
poverty. Right.
I mean, just think about that, poverty. Right. I mean, those are things that are tremendous impacts. And that gets back to, it's not only ACEs, it's the community environment sense. There's that one, that's the pair of ACEs, about adverse childhood experiences as well as adverse community environments that look at things like poverty, homelessness, education, all those social determinants. That's the foundation, So because if you live in poverty, you have less opportunity, you're more likely to have neglect about not having enough food or clothing or shelter. Mm-hmm. So it contributes to the community environments, especially impacted by poverty or racism, can impact that.
Because I thought about that too, as they were testing that one child, and if they came up with a score that says your child has some stress symptoms or whatever, we want to find out what that, does the parent get defensive? Like, I'm being a good parent and I'm doing everything I can, and so how do you cross that border? And that's where the counselors or whatever come in.
I feel like parenting shame too.
Exactly.
In general, different ways you can parent well, but they're all different, and certain parents can be very cruel.
So it's that, when you're trying to get there, but can't, because the parent is going to be defensive, and then will they come back? And access to child or access to medical care as well ends at that point.
And that's where there has to be that trusted messenger. I know Cindy and I were asked to be involved in the Micronesian Islander community. I don't know if Cindy told you about this, but when we met with the members of that community and the community health worker, and they talked a lot about the norms, and it's very much a tribal community, and there is still corporal punishment. That it's very normal, and so you begin to talk, and our conclusion as to that is that we were the wrong people to go in and present to them about ACEs, that it needed to be somebody from their own culture. We could work with somebody, but for two white women to go be talking to these parent leaders in the Micronesian Islander community, it was not a fit. So, we're working on a different way of doing that than we originally thought in the grant that they had gotten at WSU, was a Northwest Health Foundation impact grant. And there's a different way that we're going to do that, provide that information than, going in, because there's so many cultural issues there, especially where violence is very normal in that, in terms of normal to have to beat up the kid, We know that's not okay, but we can't go in. We've got to bring somebody into that tribe.
And I think that goes back, Dave, to what you were saying, and also what Bob was saying with regard to it is, it has to be, we have to really look at that awareness, that understanding at all different levels. And it can't just be that, you go in and you make one policy level change and that solves the problem. It is truly an organic and educational, it starts with education and awareness, but then it moves to that policy level at some point. And how do we do that as a community? How do we do that
with our Board of Health. How do we get there? What do we want to focus on? And I think that that's what this film really gets to. And when we are looking at different sorts of policy changes, how do we make sure that our Board of Health is also educated on these things? So as they're making decisions for the county and for policy that will affect the county, how do we make sure that there's that awareness there? How are we on time? Oh my gosh, it's 8 o'clock. Holy moly. Okay. All right. Well, this has been a very good discussion. Next meeting, what we will do is we will be talking about, we've got the Safer Homes coming in, and we've also got Katie Budd from Council for Homeless coming in next meeting. Safer Homes is really an organization. I talked about it a little bit last time. They work on suicide prevention and gun safety. So they're coming down and they're going to be presenting about how we can, as an organization, bring in non-traditional types of people to the table to have those discussions, retailers, NRA, that sort of thing. So that's next meeting. Did you want to see if there's any
council member updates that anybody has?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for being so engrossed in the conversation. I appreciate you all coming. I hope this was a good foundational discussion to, again, as we continue to look at these issues, this is a good foundation. If you have any feedback, let us know. And next meeting, it's fourth Tuesday of the month. Just remember
here.
That. Here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Should you guys own that?
We do own that now. So we are actually presenting this at different community venues, which is great. So yes, we did. We bought the video with some grant funds, actually. So yeah, if you're interested in...
I'd like to have the dispatchers watch it at some
perfect
point.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And we've heard
about
the ACES Action Alliance.
Uh-huh.
Did you like it? Yeah. I wish there was more of a male perspective, like a father or something like that. It's all, you know, moms. Which unfortunately is probably reality, but I'm sure there are some really good dads that have, you know, and those young men that decided to become more kind of father figures for some of those other boys. But I wish there was a little bit more
focus on that.
But
yeah,
but maybe harder to find.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Have a good, like a watchdog program.
Yeah.